Blog Talk Radio.
Consuming, eating, deleting, ruining.
trying to get paper. Gotta have land, gotta have acres. So I can sit back like Jack Nicholson, watch niggas play the game like the Lakers. In a world full of 52 fakers, gypsies, seances, mystical prayers. You superstitious, throw salt over your shoulders, make a wish for the day, cuz like somebody got a doll of me. Sticking needles in my artery, but I can't feel it. Sometimes it's like part of me, but I got a real big spirit. I'm fearless, I'm fearless. Don't you try to grab hold of my soul. It's like a military soldier, 10-7 years old. I held real dead bodies in my arms, felt their body turn cold. Oh, why are we born in the first place if this is how we gotta go? Dang. To all the wisdom and knowledge seekers of the world. Sabali. Patience. Yeah.
Free of the Land. Welcome to another edition of Visionary Public Radio Show. I'm your host, Minister Buman Shakir. The provision of government is a revolutionary government, a revolutionary foundation. When I say revolution, I mean total complete change, change of a social, change of a cultural, change of economical, change of political, and change of militarily. When I do army military, I'm not speaking just in the aspect of self-defense. I mean in the aspect of being able to defend yourself, mind, body, and soul, being able to defend yourself against food, being able to defend yourself psychologically, and so forth and so on. The Provisional Republic of Africa believes in, one, that exploitation and oppression of blacks in North America by whites in North America to enter the more vicious and invisible stage. Two, blacks in North America are in a serious danger of extermination like the Native Americans. Three, African borns in America survive and liberate ourselves if we understand that our problems are created by all white government, USA, they're being continued by all white government. Four, individual or organizations, no matter how rich or large, cannot wage a correct struggle for survival and liberation against the United States government. Five, we can only survive and liberate ourselves by becoming real black nationalists and building ourselves a nation that will be able to wage the correct struggle for our survival and liberation. Six, we should be the ones to determine our own destiny. This is known as self-determination. Seven, that we must stand ready to defend ourselves against our enemies by any means necessary. Eight, must support all liberation struggles and liberation in general of the African continent. Nine, the economic needs of our nation will be met and probably be shared equally. Ten, the provisional government wants all black people to help us make the Republic of Africa, the black nation, a nation of a government of black people. I'm going to liberate black territory, free the land. I would like to make an announcement. I also say that my co-host will be a little late today, which is Mr. Interior Akin McKaylee. The announcement I want to make that yesterday we experienced the death of one of our former New African political prisoners from the West Coast of California, the Elder Paul Redd, known as PR, known as Mu May. He did 43 years behind enemy lines. The brother was very sufficient in legal matters and legal statutes, and he assists a lot of brothers in regard to getting their freedom, their liberation behind enemy lines. The brother was an educator. He was a strong advocate of Black August since the inception and made the spirit of the brother live on forever. Long live resistance. Long live Paul Redd. Okay. And I'd like to welcome to the show tonight, Mama Ifia Nwangaza. How you doing, Mama? Free to learn.
By any means necessary. Good, and yourself?
I'm well. I'm strong, pushing forward. Being inspired by the ancestors and the elders, such as yourself, being inspired as much as possible. You know, the first thing you want to do, introduce yourself and give a brief of your history, involvement, and background.
Well, I'm the daughter of Garveyites, veteran of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, past successor Sophia Bukhari and served as the second co-chair of National Jericho. And co-founder of any number of additional organizations, Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, National Coalition for Blacks for Reparations in America, and COBRA, and currently serve as the founding director of the Malcolm X Center for Human Rights and Self-Determination and WMXP Community Radio here in Greenville, South Carolina. So I'm a lifelong struggler. And
true indeed.
Freedom fighter.
True indeed. First off, like, thank you for coming to our broadcast to show your natural understanding. I want to thank you for all the work you contributed in the past, the work you contributed presently, and the work you're going to do in the future. And my second question is, what is reparations?
Reparations is reparatory justice. And what do we mean by reparatory? Reparations, in order to repair African people who were captured, kidnapped, and enslaved in North America for the past 500 years, means making us whole, providing to us the resources necessary actually for us to make ourselves whole. We have to we have to determine what it is that we've lost or that was taken from us more accurately, and that is necessary to heal the intergenerational trauma from which we currently suffer and have suffered as a result of 500 years of captivity. We're under a system that was designed to reduce us to beast of burden. And although the system was designed to reduce us to beast of burden, we were able to hold on to our humanity, our dignity, our worth. And though at times it seems unlikely, even our self-respect, that the fact of our survival is an act of resistance in and of itself, and a show of respect for our ancestors and the contribution that they made, not just to this country, but to our survival. We have lost a clear understanding, a clear recognition of our Africanity, the elements of our Africanity, even as we practice and live as Africans in North America. So we have some folk who talk about reparations as a cash payout. I think William Dougherty is probably the most well-recognized of the folk who speak in those terms. But to talk about reparations or repair in such simplistic terms is not to understand what has been taken from us and what it means to be human, fully human. For instance, if we use the analogy of an automobile accident, when someone is injured in an automobile accident, not only are their medical bills paid, but their lost wages are restored. Any future harm that or disability that the injured party is expected to have is projected, calculated, at least estimated, and they're compensated. That means that you're going to have chronic pain for the rest of your life, then that has to be addressed, whether it's physical, mental, spiritual. It has to be addressed. That's a part of the making whole process. That's a part of the healing process. Future lost wages, not just the lost wages up until the time of settlement or judgment, but the amount of wages that would be lost and diminished in the future. Does that mean that you can't work on somebody else's job or you can't start your own business? Your economic development. So we got education, health, housing, and of course that's the basis of the demand for the five states. South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, where, of course, the majority of us still live. So it's a broad spectrum of elements that have to come together to make us whole. And then there's the matter of not being subjected to continued violence and terrorism. And the U.S. government, as untrustworthy as it is, being held responsible for making sure that there are no more Tulsas or Rosewoods or Wilmingtons or Elaine, Arkansas. There are no more massacres. There's no more rewriting of the laws in such a way as to be able, by eminent domain or highway department funds, planning, to again deprive us of the results of our labor and our recovery. All of those are mechanisms that have over time been used to deprive us of the benefits, the fruits of our labor. Sister Dorothy Lewis used to talk about a special entitlement that Black women are entitled to as a result of the theft of our children, the fruit of the womb. And what are the benefits? What are what are we entitled to as a result of that special, peculiar kind of pain that comes as a result of selling away a mother's child? So the concept of repair and the elements that come together to constitute repair are wide-ranging, but most important is the process of us deciding what that is and demanding it. And that's what some people would call internal reparations, that we are repairing ourselves and asserting our dignity and worth and humanity in that demand. So it is the masses of our people that have to define what the specifics are going to be. It can't be a handful of us sitting in a room deciding what we think is the answer. Even when we use international reparations standards, we still have a duty to educate the masses of the people and to hear from them the application of those standards in defining what will constitute our reparations.
True indeed. I'm gonna ask you two more questions. I'm gonna pass it on to my co-host. My next question is, how does international law relate to the attainment of reparation?
Well, international law specifically provides for reparations. The concept of reparations is a long-standing it's an ancient concept and practice. I can't off the top of my head go so far back, but trying to think of an example, an ancient example, and maybe someone listening will call in and help us with that. The concept of repair, the concept of compensation is not a new one generally, and it is not especially for this country. Folk think back, think about the Jewish Holocaust and the Jews being compensated by the Germans, and actually the United States, for reasons that still escape me, also contributed to reparations to the victims of the Jewish Holocaust. It continues to pay reparations in the sense that the state of Israel not only exists, but that it receives the largest foreign aid from the United States, $3 billion plus per year, in addition to all kinds of other military assistance and supports for scientific and technological study and advancement. We, in this country, we refer to the Japanese who were interned in concentration camps and who were awarded $20,000 each and a letter of apology for that human rights violation. In addition to that, and perhaps even more importantly, was the pardoning of their political prisoners. Their political prisoners having been persons who refused to serve in the U.S. military and who fought and resisted the internment. That is, of course, one of our primary demands, that our political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles, we don't include our exiles when we talk about political prisoners and prisoners of war, just because people aren't in physical custody, the fact that they are, their liberty and their security is prescribed by the enemy means that they are not not only not fully free, but they're not even free to function fully as human beings. They're constantly having to look over their shoulder. They're constantly at risk of being captured, kidnapped, and returned. There's the business of being an exile is a very oppressive and violative, violent way of life. So we should not forget, in addition to Asada, is Pete O'Neill in Tanzania. And it seems to me that there are at least one or two other people who are exiles. We need to make expressly include them in our references. We know that under some circumstances, Native Americans have received reparations from the U.S. government and been entitled to even more, having had to sue the Bureau of Indian Affairs in order to get the resources that to which they are entitled, and to get the kind of management of those resources that they're entitled to. It's going to be interesting to see how the kidnapping and murder of Indian children in the boarding school cases is going to wind up working out in the coming years. That'll be another claim to be made against the U.S. government for its abuses. So the matter of reparations is not and restitution. We hear restitution all the time when we hear about people being convicted for in the courts in this country. They have to go to jail or go to prison for these draconian sentences and make restitution. So it's time for the United States government to make restitution.
True indeed. When you mentioned the ancient aspects, would you consider the establishment of Liberia a part of their repertory just that you're talking about? That's just something I thought about when you're talking about in regards to ancient aspects of reparation. Mm-hmm. Would Liberia be considered that in your mind from your professionality?
That's an interesting question, because there are those of us who seek repatriation as a form of reparations. And the folk who, as I understand it, the folk who went to Liberia and set up Liberia did so voluntarily. I don't think that the United States provided the kind of support that was necessary for it to be a successful colony, successful and independent nation. In fact, the United States, and as we look at the history of it, especially the Firestone Rubber Company, reduce it to a colony that it exploited. So I'm not sure that I know enough about what actually happened with regard to the establishment of Liberia, the voluntariness, the resources that were made available. We know that also that there were people in Liberia when the Africans from North America went to Liberia. What was their relationship with the indigenous population there? I don't think it was a very, I think it was a hostile relationship, certainly in the beginning. So we had another settler colony, except that it was established by Africans formerly in the U.S., from the U.S. If okay. Under different circumstances, I would say that where it was a healthy interaction between the two peoples and a mutually agreed upon, mutually beneficial, then that could be an example of reparations. But I don't think that I know enough to be able to say that it was a fair exchange between the indigenous people and the incoming population, even though the incoming population was also African.
I actually appreciate your assessment, right? You know, it was just something I thought off the top of my head. But then my last question, would the release of catch new African citizens, new African political prisoners, new African POWs be an act of reparations?
It would be, yes. I think that it would be, and it would, along with being an act of a part, an element of reparations, it would also be a way of declaring an end to the war against African people, certainly African people in captivity in North America. We know that when wars end, even and sometimes depending on who the prisoners are, during the war itself, you may have a prisoner exchange. But certainly at the end of a war, the prisoners of war are returned to their people, to their country. So it would be an expression of the end of the war on Africa generally, and the war on this African population to release our prisoners and to compensate them for the harm that has been done to them. I think that there's another category of prisoners that we have to also look at, and that's what I call prisoners of politics, you know, the political prisoners, prisoners of war, exiles, and prisoners of politics, and that's the victims or survivors of mass incarceration. and the use of the criminal punishment system ever since the Civil War to maintain our enslavement. You know, people like to think that the 13th Amendment ended slavery. No, the 13th Amendment did not end slavery. It just moved it from private hands to public hands, to government hands. So we wind up with generation after generation of our people being forced into servitude under the guise of criminal behavior. And of course, what winds up being criminal behavior is whatever the potential employer calls criminal behavior. I mean, what could be more criminal than polluting a river and killing off the wildlife in the river, depriving the folk who drink the water from the river of clean water? I mean, the spoiling of the environment is one of the greatest crimes of all. So it's not only a crime against humanity, it's a crime against nature.
Sure, indeed. I want to thank you for that. I'm about to pass it on to my co-host, Minister Akin Bekele, so you can ask some questions. I appreciate you, sister. Really lamb, Mom.
By any means necessary. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Free the lamb, Mama Efe. This is Brother Akin Bekele. How are you this evening?
Better and better. How about yourself?
Oh, I'm doing strong. It's good to be able to have these conversations with like-minded individuals. So that always put me in a better space when I'm able to elevate my understanding with those who come before me. So I appreciate you taking out time to speak with us this evening.
It's my honor.
I'll just keep it going. So one thing that I wanted to ask, from your perspective, reparations, you mentioned that the release of the new African political prisoners of war, and also the prisoners of politics. Would you say it would be, I guess, advantageous if we were to only just get the release of our brothers and sisters as a way to call the statement of ending a war? Or would you feel like some monetary given back from the United States would be also be included as well? Why or why not?
Oh, absolutely. It goes without saying that there has to be monetary compensation. And along with the monetary compensation, there are other elements that are required. For instance, when we look at just staying on the subject of prisoners of any category, to have been locked up, tortured, deprived, in some instances, deprived of human contact, separated from one's family, community, the psychological impact of that experience in and of itself is devastating and causes all kinds of emotional, spiritual and physical disability. The level of medical neglect that is practiced not occurs, but practice in penal in the penal system in this country in and of itself is a harm that has to be corrected. So that means that people coming out of the prison system have to have remedial health care in order to address the effects of the diet that they have been subjected to. Even people who have whose family has the resources to support them to the extent that they can eat out of the canteen, as it said, still have health issues as a result of the diet to which they have been subjected to. And think about that diet, the sodium, the sugar, the lack of fresh fruits and vegetables, without even getting into the people who are spend years in the hole. That has to be addressed, and that's a part of reparations. People on the outside, those of us who live in food deserts, whose only access to buying, shopping for food is a convenience store. Some of the dollar stores now have frozen foods, which is generally considered somewhat better. However, it's still not fresh produce, and given the limited exposure and access, knowing how to prepare them. So the disruption of our whole nutritional well-being, whether we're locked up in cages or we're on the longer leash in urban areas or across this country, we are still affected by nutritional homicide. Let's look at the educational system. Not having access to education. You take a 17-year-old kid and sentence him to 20 years in prison with no educational support. What is the outcome of that? How do you compensate him or her mentally, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually? And the fact that that another 17-year-old isn't is on the street, but still not having access to information and technology. He or she fares only slightly better. There's a new book out entitled, his name was George Floyd. And the authors, two Washington Post reporters, are the authors, and they do a whole analysis of the life of George Floyd and his effort to be able to try to survive and to realize his human potential in this society, and the barriers that he dealt with repeatedly and consistently throughout, noting the fact that at an earlier point that his grandparents, I'm trying to grandparent, grandfather or great-grandfather, had actually been a landowner. There's another book that entitled The Invisible Child that tells the story of a young girl in New York, and George Floyd was in, I believe it's Houston, Texas, maybe it may be Dallas, but in Texas, an urban area in Texas. And the second book, The Invisible Child, is New York and how the grandfather of this young girl, who's the subject of the book, was a GI, but because of discriminatory practices both in housing and the access to GI benefits, she and her mother, his daughter, the GI's daughter, wind up homeless and living from one shelter to another in the city of New York. The psychological as well as the material impact of that lifestyle as a continuing intergenerational traumatic effect on the development of us individually and collectively. So the range of elements of reparation is full spectrum. I'm not sure that I responded to you.
No, yes, you most definitely did, and I appreciate the way you did, because I know a lot of times in the media, when someone mentions reparations, you know, they always try to associate it with black people just going out and buying new cars and, you know, just doing frivolous things with the money. But I really appreciate the way you broke it down into what was actually systemic and the actual problems that we would have to face with bringing those captured prisoners home, as well as the systemic issues that have been plaguing us all throughout us being brutalized here in America. So I really appreciate that. And so to take that one step further, when it comes to an actual way of receiving reparations, how do you feel international law will affect that? Like what place or what role, if any, do you feel international law will come in to actually allowing us to see reparations one day in our lifetime, if possible?
Well, I meant to mention it earlier, so I'll suggest it now. I'll raise it now. And that is that with the UN World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa, in 2000, where slavery, colonialism, and apartheid were declared by the United Nations as crimes against humanity. One keeps the claim alive, and therefore a basis for making a claim for reparations. But even before that, it keeps our claim alive. But even before that, with regard to reparations, again, there's so many examples of restitution, reparations, repair being made to various groups of people, and that I just cited. Whether or not we'll see it in our lifetime, I think that we're closer to it than I've ever seen it in my lifetime. I'm 75, and reparations, I can't remember a time in my life when reparations was not a part of the conversation. I can remember being 3 years old and doing a ditty about reparations and about get back what was stolen. You know, it used to be a time when we would, in the churches, you'd have, you know, the young people's programs, and all the young people got to participate. That was one of the things that I was so impressed with when I went to, you know, African Nation Day this year, and the Watoto performing. We don't have that space now for young people to develop their talents, develop their leadership abilities the way that we have in the past. We need to get back to that on a broad scale. You know, there's still pockets. We know that the New African People's Organization has an annual camp in Zico, where that's common. That's a part of the standard, this, or Kilimbo, the Freedom School there in Atlanta. But that was common practice throughout the community, and we need to reestablish those opportunities and those requirements. That so we see various forms of restitution emerging. I was just watching this evening's news, and on one of the stations, well, actually on both of them, and I think it's interesting because today is Juneteenth, the second federal holiday, and on two, the BBC and CBS both talked about the economic disparity and deprivation of African community in the United States. On one, the disparity in income, the difference in the income and assets, the assets of whites being six times that of black folks. And we know from various other studies that it would take 500 years without reparations for us to gain parity with whites, with the income, the rate of the income disparity, wage disparity, asset disparity, that in order to reach parity. So that the notion of black capitalism, the notion of affirmative action, none of that has the potential for doing justice. In the other instance, the other report was talking about, the BBC report was talking about discriminatory banking practices. And while it's no longer called redlining, but the so-called standards for being able to access the banking system for us is completely different than the requirements for whites. And unless we're going to buy a car, then we're pretty much shut out of it. So we have so-called gentrification, or what I call Anglo cannibalization, of historically black neighborhoods and black property. We have predatory lending. We have eminent domain. We have rabid code enforcement that results in the instances where there is ownership, the depreciation or devaluation and ultimate dispossession of property. It was interesting that they had a Miami Urban League director saying that, blaming us, actually, blaming the victim, saying that one of the reasons that we're dispossessed of property is because we have been conditioned to not buy property but to be renters instead. I certainly hope that the National Urban League office will be informed of this misrepresentation and call him to account for that insult and assault on our efforts to survive in this society.
All right. And so, with that, how do you feel or what do you think international law would help us to kind of bring those things to the front, the forefront, to be able to stand on those and to be able to bring that out into the forefront for everyone? Do you even think that international law can do that to help shine that light on those discriminatory practices you mentioned, such as redlining or predatory lending and things of that nature?
Well, let me say this about international law. International law is not like we think of domestic law, that you can take take a treaty and sue the United States government in its court or an international court and get justice. It's going to be interesting. There's purportedly some effort to bring a lawsuit, a genocide lawsuit against the U.S. government. And if successful, that would certainly be a mechanism for recovering damages. And to the extent that a treaty has been ratified and thus is has become, as a result, U.S. law, provides a basis for litigation. However, as Malcolm said, we should take our enemy to the United Nations, take our enemy to the international court, but the United States is not a party to any international court. It's not a party to a signatory to the International Criminal Court. It is limited in terms of its the impact of the United Nations investigatory bodies. In fact, there are investigatory bodies that are right now petitioning the United States for permission to come in and do investigations on the treatment of black people in this country.
Okay.
So what the usefulness of international law for reparations purposes, in large measure, as it's discussed, is the standards. What are the standards to which a member of the United Nations can be held in order to meet its international obligations? But the United Nations has no powers of enforcement.
Mm.
I would also remind us that the United States Supreme Court has no powers of enforcement and issues, for instance, Brown versus the Board of Education, ordering schools to be desegregated in this country. And that has yet to be enforced. In fact, there is a rapid reversal with vouchers and the draining of public school funds to underwrite what are fast becoming the restoration of the white Christian academies. So it's the on one hand, it's the largesse, the goodwill of the government, the of an administration, to see that the laws are enforced. That failing, then it's barely worth the paper that it's written on. It's the people who got the guns that make the difference. When we get right down to it, and unless you have the ability to enforce, to protect and promote a position, then it's little more than a position. And we look at electoral politics across this country. Black electoral bodies are disenfranchised by white Republican right wing state governments that take over the city council, the school district, the school board, and superimpose on it whatever its will is. It's very much like the way Puerto Rico has been treated, where the United States went in and discounted the elected government and put in a bunch of businessmen and just who do what they want to do in their own commercial interest. I mean, it's the perfect understanding of what it means to be colonized. We say we are a colonized people, and we are. So the question, I think, becomes, How do we decolonize ourselves and able to maintain a decolonized status and defend that status? Part of it, of course, is maintaining international relations with other countries, other peoples, but even with that, we're still talking about the power of public opinion. That's a great deal of the success of the civil rights movement had to do with the fact that African countries were gaining their independence, and the United States in the Cold War against the Soviet Union wanted to use the powers of persuasion to bring them to the U.S. camp. So they had to appear to be addressing the needs and the treatment of African people in the United States. So the idea that our salvation is going to come through international law is not as well placed, in my opinion, as you may be encouraged to think. I'm sure that there's some who would disagree with me, but I spent a substantial amount of time going back and forth to Geneva. Spent a substantial amount of time obtaining advanced degrees in history, including U.S. history. So I've got a combination of theory and practice. And that's not to say that we should not view those mechanisms as tools. We need to also recognize the severe limitations. We can applaud and salute the people in Colombia who just had an election and elected what is described as a leftist government. And that the president, a leftist president, and vice president is Afro-Colombian woman. It was interesting that in this evening's coverage of the election results, the reporter also interviewed one of the oligarchs, in Colombia. And she was clutching her pearls and wringing her hands, talking about how they expected the economy to collapse because the government is saying that they're going to make the rich pay their fair share. I think that we have to gather as many tools and weapons as we can, but we must always recognize their limitations. And international law is just such a view that we should take.
Okay. Thank you for that. That definitely makes sense to not stand on international law as the end all be all, but like you said, just another tool in our toolbox to obtain our goal. That makes sense. And so you mentioned your work with the Geneva. How does the Geneva Convention view new African political prisoners and new African prisoners of war?
It's questionable whether or not the Geneva Conventions would be applied to our people. That was one of my point of disappointment for me in 1991, I believe it was, when there was a tribunal in New York. Dr. Imario Bedelli, along with others, presented our case before this body of international jurists, and they did not, first of all, recognize our struggle as a liberation struggle. And two, they did not declare our political prisoners and prisoners of war as such, as freedom fighters. And, of course, I carried that same burden in appearing before the subcommittees of the treaty reviews of the UN Human Rights Council, the review of the United States under the Universal Periodic Review, which is a country-to-country review, to determine whether or not each country is living up to its international obligations. And three other treaties, the International Convention for Civil and Political Rights, Convention Against Torture, and CERD, Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which those three are expert reviews where the government and civil society make presentations, and a formal report comes out of that. And while I was in each instance successful in raising the issue of political prisoners under the rubric of imprisoned COINTELPRO civil rights era human rights defenders, human rights activists, the term political prisoner, prisoner of war, and exiles was not formally used, even when their names were specifically called, except in the case of the Universal Periodic Review, where Cuba, Venezuela, and Iran raised the issue, Cuba being the only of the three countries that actually put their, as they call them, concerns in writing and call for the release of political prisoners and prisoners of war, and generally and more specifically for Mamia Abu-Jamal and Leonard Peltier. So theoretically, if the United Nations had any had powers of enforcement, then it could have brought meaningful pressure to bear against the United States to get those people released. But it's the United Nations and the way that the governments. Members, it's by consent. You know, they have to say, okay, well, you know, we're going to accept that criticism. They don't have to even accept the criticism, much less implement it. And I'm not sure that I have not gone off from the question that you asked, whether or not our political prisoners would be recognized under the Geneva Convention. The Geneva Convention has specific elements, like you have to have a uniform and it has to be readily recognized. I think that in some ways that has given guerrilla warfare that it's beginning to be looser, that it's less rigid. But at the same time, the code has not been rewritten, so you can be a combatant. Mm-hmm. We heard a lot about combatants in Afghanistan and as it relates to like Al-Qaeda or ISIS or other formations that are at war against various forces, whether it's the United States or religious. And I'm not sure that all these religious wars are, in fact, religious. So as much religious as they are wars of liberation in some instances, because not trusting the media and the quality of the information that is available to the general public in this country. So but we would be in large measure in that same category, except, of course, in the case of Dr. Mutulu Shakur, who declared himself a prisoner of war and was recognized by the judge in his case as being a prisoner of war. That I would have to admit, is the exception rather than the rule.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, thank you for your insight on that. And so I'm going to ask one more question. And then at that point, I'm going to open up the line. So if anyone has any comment or question, please press 1. But for my final question, you mentioned that you believe that one way to actually to be able to make changes would be to be able to enforce it by, you know, being able to have weapons to be able to stand for what you want to have done, to be able to defend yourselves. With that in mind, do you feel that the uptick in mass shootings around the country is a strategy being done to create a stigma against those who would use weapons to defend themselves? So that if there was a cause such as reparations where we chose to use arms to defend our points, there would be a stigma against us, and then that public opinion of us doing that would eventually cause us to not be able to gain as much traction as we would have had these mass shootings and that stigma for having guns and owning guns had not happened in the United States.
Well, first of all, the whole concept of guns, I mean, when you put black and guns in the same sentence in this country, it triggers an ancient ancient programming. Even in the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, on the verge of losing the war, was still hesitant to engage black soldiers because of the fear of putting guns in black hands, that whether or not we could be trusted to not fight for our own freedom on either side. So the current rash of so-called mass shootings, you know, it's like 4 white people get killed and that's a massacre, when they've been going around wiping out whole nations, is propaganda. You know, it's really programming that has less to do with us, even though in their minds, when they hear of a shooting, the first question that comes to mind is, was the shooter black? No, the shooter was a young white boy who was probably on prescribed psychotropic drugs, who, for whatever reason that he, invariably it's a he, although I understand there's 1 or 2 instances where it was a she. I know in California they try to claim that this Muslim woman was a party to the confrontation that her partner had with his former employer. But for the most part, young white males. They still think in terms of black. You know, there's just some issues in the minds of white people that are black issues. When they think about drugs, even though studies show that blacks and whites do drugs in comparable amounts, and certainly certain drugs in comparable amounts, there's a tendency to think that black people do more drugs. That's why we wind up in jail more for drugs. But it, you know, it's not. That's not the reason. The reason that we wind up in jail more is because we're over-policed more, and because we are the fodder for the criminal punishment system, the criminal punishment industry, and we are redundant labor. And the only way that they can get the continue to get free labor is by locking us up, mass incarceration, and requiring folks to work once they've been locked up. So it doesn't have, it has the view of us with the exercising, first of all, the Second Amendment, and more importantly, the human right of self-defense, doesn't have anything to do with what is real. It has, even in our own minds, it has to do more with the programming that we've had over these 500 years. The punishment for whites who would sell guns to Indians, to Native Americans, was substantially greater than punishment for any range of other offenses. In fact, it could be a capital offense depending on how many and to which nation the guns were being sold. So the understanding, and of course everybody remembers the situation in California with the Black Panther Party going to Sacramento, the capital, while the legislature was arguing about gun control, and they're showing up with guns, and how that was the beginning of the modern trove of gun control laws that have been passed. When there are instances of self-defense, for instance, with Philando Castile, when people here, he had a carry permit. He was clean as the board of health, as my mother would say, and as right as rain. And the NRA would not come out in his defense. Never comes out in defense of black people. In the Second Amendment, so it's not it's much deeper and much has a much longer history. The attitudes about black people and self-defense, that's another reason why we get the sanitized version of Martin Luther King. Never mind Martin Luther King had a gun permit, had a gun. What's his face? Charlie Cobbs, one of my colleagues from SNCC, the Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, wrote a whole book about this nonviolence will get you killed. Brother Akinyele Umoja wrote a book, We Shoot Back. But those that side of the freedom movement in this country is rarely mentioned, much less talked about, because the programming is a quote-unquote bloodless revolution, as Malcolm mentioned. There's no such thing. Even in India with Gandhi, there was an armed formation. There were armed formations, the most effective of which is reportedly a women's wing. We know that for those of us old enough, and some of you can be industrious enough to go and find the film The Battle of Algiers, which talks about the use of force in self-defense, and both defensive and offensively. So there's no such thing as a bloodless revolution. And I would echo Martin Luther King when he said that the person who has not found something for which he, and I would say she, is not willing to die is not fit to live. In fact, they're not living. So, you know, I think I would add, I often think about the Vietnamese people who defeated not only the French, but the U.S. as well. So that we have to make a decision about what our priorities are. You know, is it to as James Brown would say, to continue living on our knees or standing on our feet? And I'm paraphrasing that wrong. I'm sure there's somebody who understands, knows that that song and what the lyric actually is. But the sense of it is it's as I've said. So it doesn't have anything to do with what we do or don't do. It has to do with what the conditioning, the mental conditioning, the propaganda that has already been sold. You know, the question is what are our priorities and what is our willingness to establish consistency between what we say and what we do.
Excellent. Thank you. I really appreciate the way you brought it down. Thank you. And that actually was a very good movie, The Battle of Algiers. I have had the pleasure of watching that movie, and I wholeheartedly agree with your parallels with that movie. So at this time, I am going to open it up for anyone that has any questions or comments. So I see one person, caller 614-285. Your line is open. Caller 614-285. Your line is open for your comments or questions.
What ARD, free land.
By any means,
big sis,
there, mama.
Big sis, it is so good to hear your voice. This is your little sister, Condi, and I'm really tickled to hear you as usual. I have a response to some of what you said, because you covered a lot of territory. So I'm going to try to respond in 3 points. One, I remember when the PGRNA first began and how we used to,
the artists would make up flyers and posters and mail them and staple them to the poles in the streets, especially in North Philly, because that's where I was at the time, and have different locations, whether it was the UNIA building or the Church of the Advocate where the first Black Power Conference took place, or the Panther Party office around the corner, or the Moorish bookstore down the street, would have these flyers and give them out in the neighborhoods. And the flyers were us having workshops and classes on how to use reparations once we receive it. That was a lot of territory. You know, almost every Black person in North Philly knew what reparations was. They knew you don't get it and then go spend it on sneakers or a car or, you know, something frivolous like that. And I see that as being something we're going to have to seriously focus on again, because we've been moved far away from that, you know, and you've got other non-new African people talking about reparations, and they're defining it totally different from how we have defined it. The next thing you maybe think of when you were talking about reparations and the quality of it, what we decide what's going to be reparations, made me think about all the babies I've delivered and the quality, the quality, the health care that those of us who deliver babies and immunize them herbally and homeopathically and then educate them K through 12, what we provide, what that looks like, and also our preparation to stand up and defend that, because I've had prosecutors and everybody else show up at my door trying to tell me I didn't have the right to do those things. But also, more metaphorically, the quality, for example, of health care that you mentioned, it made me think of, so when a sister is torn, when she delivers her baby, does she let these crackers sew her up in the hospital, or does she use a herbal and homeopathic vaginal wash, which knits the skin back together? I see reparations like that. Which repair do we want? One that leaves a scar, or one that knits back and you can't even tell there ever was a tear? And since I'm blind, the third thing, I wasn't able to make notes, so if you respond to me, maybe my third thought will resurrect itself. And it's good to hear you. I can't even begin to tell you.
My pleasure, my honor. I'm glad. It's good to hear you sound as strong and clear.
Humbled. I've been on since you started in the beginning, and I pushed one so that when we got to the callers being able to speak with you, I would already have that taken care of and figured out how to do it. My phone is horrible. And about midway, I got a message saying, thank you for using Blog Talk Radio, like the show was over. I don't know if it happened to anybody else, but it did happen to me. And so I called back, pushed one again, and I made it. I held on. When I first called in tonight, it said there was no broadcast. I mean, it just then it was a different number on a flyer, and so, you know, when we're determined, we get what we need to do done, in spite of all of that. Thank you. I thought of the third thing. Our brothers and sisters behind the walls. I've been doing that kind of work since I was a teenager in Philly. And here we are now in this time, and the work still needs to be done. It's almost like nothing has changed. It's like finding out June 19th, 1865, that you're allegedly free, but Juneteenth has to be celebrated all the way to August 1st, when the last black folk found out they were free. So it's like a whole several month process, you know. And it's the same thing with our brothers behind the walls, because things have not changed for them, for the sisters behind the walls. Things have not changed. And I remember when I finally got locked up, when I finally ended up in solitary confinement, and the 50 or more brothers and sisters that I used to material support, spiritual support, political support, I became one of them. And I got the chance to see what it looked like on the other side of the fence, you know, in solitary confinement. You know, I went from 148 pounds to 76 pounds. I got a chance to see, you know, for myself what the conditions were and are, because nothing's changed, for our brothers and sisters behind the walls. And I still, in spite of my condition, I'm 70 now, I'm blind, I'm in a wheelchair, I still try to do everything I can. And I have to admit that I'm extremely excited that two weeks ago, soon to be out of, finally, it's free. And I remember when Jahlil Muntakim came out, and I was just, I was in tears. You know, I was in tears. And he was on some show, I don't remember what the show was, and I called in and I let him know that I was listening, and that he still has my support if he needs anything. I'm still a humble servant. And he made me cry. He said, "I love you, little sister Kanvi." And I was like, "Oh." You know, because when you're doing work to support and free our people, you don't really look up to see and take inventory, you know. You're just doing the work. You got your, like an ostrich, your head is buried and you're just going, just doing it. And when somebody speaks up and says, you know, says something like that, it humbles your heart. And I just thank you that you're still doing all this work. I mean, I guess this is my little way of trying to say thank you for not giving up, for continuing, you know, in this fight, in this struggle. And I'll leave you with this one comment. Even though I'm blind, I'm still swinging, and every now and then I hit something. I love you, Vixen.
All right. All right.
I yield.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for that.
It's a pleasure to hear from you. You know, the and I appreciate your comments and your observations and reminders. It's so frustrating. My father used to say, and I every day I appreciate more and more little comments that he would make. Somebody said, the older you get, the smarter your parents get. But he used to say to us, you all behave as if you think you invented the civil rights movement. What do you think we've been doing all these years? And a part of that has to do with, one, is the ignorance or underdevelopment of youth. And our ineffectiveness in conveying from one generation to the next the lessons of what from one generation to the next. I've been reading a book by his brother Leonard Moore. Entitled "How Black Power, the Civil Rights Movement, and the Gary Convention of 1972 was defeated." I think, you know, and he goes through various to who did what to whom, but the biggest lesson I think that he doesn't specifically set out, except in writing the book, is the failure to convey from one generation to the next the lessons to be learned. I was looking at my sister just finished reading the book, How the Word is Passed. You know, before social media, we actually talked to each other, and we talked to our kids, right? Not always about the things that political that we could pass from one generation and needed to be passed from one generation to the next. But there was an opportunity for that to happen. I remember when we used to pass out the flyer that had the survival list on it. And the one thing that I remember among all the different things that was on there was that if you had a dog that you should buy Alpo, because if push came to shove and you had to eat the dog's food, you could eat the Alpo because Alpo was real meat as opposed to other dog foods, which were cereals and byproducts. How much water we should store in our houses. We had a different sense of where we were and the circumstances under which we're living, and I agree with you. We need to get back on that track, even if we had relations with other countries that would come to our aid. The aid that we would need under those circumstances, and actually even need now. Living in food deserts is aid that we have to generate ourselves, mutual aid that we can support one another. So that was I really appreciate that reminder of
it's Freedom Lane. Excuse me 1 second, Mama Fia. I don't mean to cut you off, but we have one more caller. And we have about 12 minutes left on the show for the evening. So I want to get to this one last caller. And then we'll try to finish out tonight for our final reflection. So, caller 901-292, your line is unmuted. Caller 901-292, your line is unmuted.
Free the land, Mama. Yeah, this is Mama Ayo. How
are
you?
Oh, wonderful. Good, and yourself? Good to hear
you. Very, very
voice.
Fine. Good, good. I want to ask a very quick question, but before then I do want to comment. I agree with most of the salient points that you shared with us tonight, especially about reparations, about the world court, about international law. And my question is the reason I want you to consider the reason why the international court, the United Nations, really doesn't have a strong enforcement component, because many of the nations, what we call the stronger dominant nations, those that control, you know, neocolonialism, white supremacy, racism, are the very nations that are being charged with crimes against humanity, particularly when it comes to the enslavement and the degradation of African people. So we're asking the very people of Spain, France, Portugal, England, Sweden, and so on and so on, to now come back, regulate themselves, and to decide as a human body, an international body, to apologize and to come together to, you know, provide reparations, restorations, recompense. So I find it ironic, and that's why we want the nations of the world, particularly African nations, to begin to look at those paradigms and say, they have no moral authority to determine anything.
Absolutely.
So I would love you to comment on that. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the question. First of all, they never do anything that unless it's in their own interest. And that makes it even more important that we draw our own red lines. We look at the whole game that's going on around environmental justice and climate change, where nations are being wiped out because of the rise of the sea level, and how they are coming up with all kinds of machinations for not changing their behavior, from whether it's carbon, net carbon, or carbon credits that they can continue to pump carbon dioxide into the environment, into the atmosphere, and then purportedly buy off the underdeveloped countries that they have raped, robbed, and pillaged, so that they have not been able to realize their potential. No, they're not going to. All the money that they spend to go to the moon and to Mars, that they think that they're going to be able to leave here and go there, and leave the despoiled planet Earth behind. They have no intentions, and in fact, the United Nations as a peacekeeping, a justice mechanism is as impotent as is the U.S. Legal system is impotent to deliver justice to people in this country or the United Nations to the world. They are both mechanisms that that distract us from the larger pursuit of the larger devices, methods to overthrow capitalism and the ruling countries. I'm past the point of negotiating and trying to talk to these people. Sister Dr. Frances Cress Wilson told us a long time ago that the primary motivation of people who call themselves white or Western society, because they're not civilized, is fear of genetic annihilation. And we see that becoming more prominent, more public with this so-called replacement theory. There is no intention whatsoever of making any kind of changes in this country or on this planet that is going to put them at any kind of perceived, never mind actual, in their mind, disadvantage. So I don't have any confidence beyond my confidence in the people, the masses of the people. I don't mean their minions.
Parcel, moment for you. We got less than 5 minutes left. Can you give us your final thoughts?
My final thought is freedom or death.
Short and to the point.
Okay. True indeed. You know, again, we thank you for coming to our broadcast. We acknowledge your work. Thank you for the work you're contributing. Thank you for all this informative conversation. And if anybody gets this conversation, they can go on to our blog top and listen to record the show, gain a little insight. And Mama Via, do you have any information on leading people any kind of websites, any kind of content information, anything like that to find out more information about yourself, your work, or anything you said?
We have a website, WMXP955.org, community radio. We simulcast WPFW out of Washington, D.C. We're a Pacifica Network affiliate. WPFW presents some of the most salient information and programming online and on FM radio, so we simulcast them. So that's I would suggest refer to WMFP955.org.
All right, appreciate it. You know, I like to say, anyone trying to learn more about the Vision of Public Africa, go on to our website, which is www.bg-rna.com. Upon going to the website, please create an account, sign in, we can access the information. Also, if you can, and you have been sent, you know, I want to say long live the resistance, long live the new African independent move. Free of land.
By any means necessary, which is more than a slogan.
Man, to raise your hand for the land, do the work. It was all about doing the work, not live there, doing the work.